Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Definitely a challenging time of year to have an incident of this magnitude impacting park operations so dramatically.
A wildfire closes most of Denali National Park during the busiest tourism week of the year. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, amid the Cook Inlet gas shortage, many Alaskans turn to solar energy.
Our price of electricity is so high that it still pays off, even though you're not making much in the winter. You just make a lot in the summer.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Denali National Park and Preserve remains largely shut down due to a wildfire near the park entrance. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Riley Fire started Sunday afternoon about a mile north of the park entrance and across the Nenana River from the park's highway and tourist business strip known as Glitter Gulch. Park spokesperson Paul Oleg says the agency relocated approximately 150 employees from entrance area housing Sunday, and Front Country Park facilities were closed.
The park remains closed to all private vehicles and day use visitors. All public facilities remain closed today. Tour and transit bus operations are not operating. The Riley Creek campground remains closed and evacuated.
Oleg says a shuttle is being operated to bring visitors out in the park back to the entrance area. He says visitors already at campgrounds west of the park entrance are so far being allowed to stay until their reservations expire, but that could change depending on fire activity. He says power remained out in the area this afternoon and that park and fire managers were running generators for electricity. He emphasizes that the fire is happening during the busiest week of the year at Denali.
Definitely a challenging time of year to have an incident of this magnitude impacting park operations so dramatically. There are a lot of visitors who have plans to be here, and typically we would see in excess of 3,000 people a day coming into the Denali Visitor Center.
Oleg says it was a little cooler today, but there had been no rain on the fire as of this afternoon. The Riley Fire is estimated to have burned about 350 acres. And Alaska Fire Service spokesperson Beth Ipson describes an intense response with multiple resources.
50 firefighters on the ground, including 22 smoke jumpers, the Tanana Chief's fire crew, a couple of helicopters, water scoopers, both single engine and the large water scoopers, the air tankers.
She says a jetload of 4 hotshot crews from the lower 48 were scheduled to join the response today. And the aim remains to steer flames to the northwest, away from populated areas and infrastructure, as well as out of Black Spruce into higher terrain with less flammable fuels.
Towards a ridgeline and towards more kind of a hardwood type of vegetation.
The Riley Fire is suspected to be human-caused, and an AFS post says an investigator will work to determine exactly how it started. The Park Service's Oleg notes that the Riley Fire coincides with a major park wildfire anniversary.
We are almost at 100 years to the day that the 1924 fire swept through this area.
Oleg says there had not been another significant wildfire in the park entrance area until now. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
As some of Alaska's biggest wildfires burn on federal land, state crews have been taking on smaller blazes across the interior. Sam Harrell with the Alaska Division of Forestry says crews are still working today to contain the 5,500-acre Gold King Creek fire nearly 50 miles south of Fairbanks.
That's looking real good. They was able to stop the fire from crossing Gold King Creek and encroaching upon the cabin community down there. Still got about 30, 35 firefighters down there.
Crews have also contained about half of the smaller Montana Creek fire south of Talkeetna. The fire destroyed an outbuilding during a heavy air and ground response yesterday. Cooler, wetter weather has helped fire crews in south central and southwest Alaska, but Harrell says Fort Yukon, Circle, and much of the eastern interior will be under a red flag warning tomorrow, meaning hot, windy, and dry weather could lead to the development and spread of fires.
they haven't really been getting the rain that a lot of other areas of the state have been getting.
Firefighters haven't seen many major human-caused wildfires this season, which Harrell says is a sign that people are heeding burn restrictions. But as the 4th of July holiday weekend approaches, he urges Alaskans to be extra vigilant.
Enjoy a nice evening out around a campfire, but when you're done with that campfire, please drown it, stir it, drown it again, and make sure it's out, cold to the touch.
There are about 160 active wildfires burning in Alaska today. Rooftop solar panel installers have been busy the last few years as demand for affordable energy in Alaska grows. This summer, homeowners have been particularly motivated by concerns over the Cook Inlet natural gas shortage. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George has the story.
On a clear sunny day in June, Joe and Janice Banta stand in their driveway in Anchorage, awaiting a truck full of solar panels. At midday, most of the roof of their two-story house is illuminated with sun. Joe says that's enough for two rows of panels.
So you'll see a complete row of panels across the top, then kind of a second layer, and then where our giant birch tree is, it'll be held back a little bit from there.
The Bantas are self-described enthusiasts of renewable energy. There's already a solar panel mounted to the roof of the small fishing boat parked next to the garage. An electric car sits at the end of the driveway. Janice says their sons helped influence them to try to move away from fossil fuels to renewables. As a family, she says, they're concerned about climate change, which is driven by burning fossil fuels.
Because of the advantages to the environment, that's the thing that they worry about the most, really, is the future, you know, and going in the right direction. So.
Joe says it's also a good investment. After a discount from the installer, Alaska Solar, and a federal tax credit, the panels cost $16,000. He expects the energy savings to fully pay off the installation cost in just over a decade, while the panels power the house, car, and even the e-bike in his garage. Joe says another concern is the impending natural gas crunch along the rail belt. If utilities have to start importing natural gas, electricity prices are expected to jump.
Well, you know, it's just a wild card out there. We all have to kind of be a little prepared.
This energy calculus is becoming more common for Alaskan homeowners. Installers like Alaska Solar say rooftop solar panel sales have been booming. In 8 years of business, owner Ben May has seen significant growth.
It was a little bit more than the year before, and like we've been, our growth, thank God, has not been exponential lately.
Yeah, I can imagine that's like hard to keep up with. Yeah,
this ramp up is true for other companies as well. Gen Solar, an installer in Fairbanks, says this year's sales already look to be at least double last year's. Susitna Energy Solutions, which mostly does off-grid installations on cabins and lodges, says there's a huge desire to save on fuel costs. May says this growth is due to a few factors. The actual cost of solar panels has dropped. Solarize campaigns and federal incentives have helped further reduce prices. Systems are still not cheap, but recent state legislation to help individuals finance solar projects or invest in them as a community is helping make them accessible to more people. May says a lot of people, like Joe, are also trying to plan for the natural gas shortfall.
So our customers are going to be insulated from the price shock that's going to come from having to import natural gas into South Central, which is a bizarre thing, but that's what's coming in about 2027.
Anne May says Alaskans are beginning to understand that solar makes sense here, despite the limited winter daylight.
And people also need to understand that we make our power in the spring, summer, and fall, and then we get our power from the grid, just as we always have in the winter. Our price of electricity is so high that it still pays off, even though you're not making much in the winter. You just make a lot in the summer.
While it is an extremely seasonal resource, it absolutely works.
Chris Pike is a research engineer at UAF's Alaska Center for Energy and Power. He tracks the number of new residential and commercial solar projects popping up on the rail belt grid.
Early on, it was increasing exponentially. It's kind of started to trend more linear the last couple of years. Basically, that translates to about 400
rooftop installations per year on the rail belt, give or take.
Pike says the advantages of rooftop solar are growing, and it seems like it's poised to become mainstream in Alaska. As for the Bantas, Joe says, in addition to the climate benefits and the cost savings, he's just excited about how cool they'll look.
Yeah, we'll be styling, you know. It's like it's kind of shiny and like a new toy.
They're waiting on the utility to finish hooking the new panels up to the grid. He says they're looking forward to seeing their next, much lower electricity bill. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
And just a quick note, Alaska Solar is a corporate sponsor of Alaska Public Media. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Army Corps of Engineers studies permafrost from a tunnel near Fairbanks.
We need a world-class facility to support the world-class research that we're doing there. And understanding permafrost is important for the world.
That's ahead. Stay with us. A group of North Slope cities, tribes, and Alaska Native corporations is challenging a new federal restriction on oil development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Voice of the Arctic Inupiat filed a lawsuit in federal court last week that takes aim at a Biden administration rule completed in May. The rule tightens environmental restrictions on development in the NPRA, an area of federal land the size of Indiana. The lawsuit says that the Bureau of Land Management rule effectively confers wilderness status, the highest level of environmental protection, to more than 13 million acres that were previously designated for protection and bars leasing on another large swath. The advocacy organization is largely funded by the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and the North Slope Borough. It has been clamoring against the rule for months. Its campaign may have received a boost with the U.S. Supreme Court opinion last week called Loper Bright. It removes some of the latitude government agencies have had to impose regulations on matters not specified in law. Voice of the Arctic Inupiat says the people of the North Slope benefit from oil development primarily through local taxes on the industry. The revenues have funded clean water systems, sewers, schools, hospitals, and cultural programs. The group says the Biden administration's environmental restrictions threaten to reverse progress that has improved their lives. Environmental groups hailed the Biden administration rule for the reserve. They said it would protect birds, wildlife, and other resources important to subsistence. The protections in the rule helped lessen their anger at President Biden for allowing ConocoPhillips to proceed with Willow, a large oil development underway in the NPRA. The Alaska Supreme Court on Friday reversed a lower court ruling that threw the future of homeschooling in Alaska into question. The state's highest court sided with the state in a case that challenged laws around cash payments to homeschool families known as allotments. A Superior Court judge ruled in April that because some families were allowed to spend their allotments on private school classes, the laws violated a constitutional prohibition on using state funds at private schools. The head of the Department of Law's Civil Division, Corey Mills, says the High Court got it right.
The Superior Court's decision here was just disastrous, frankly, and we're really glad the Supreme Court both ruled very quickly and realized that this statute should be upheld in the circumstances and the correspondence school program should continue, which is what we asked for.
The court said plaintiffs in the case had failed to show that a 2014 law reforming the state's correspondence school system violated the state constitution. It said that because there are a range of permissible uses for allotment funds, the parents who sued to throw out the law had not met the high bar necessary to challenge a statute. Institute for Justice attorney Kirby Thomas West, who represented a group of families who used their correspondence school allotments on private school classes, also welcomed the ruling.
Yeah, I think it's really great news. This ruling means that the program is preserved and families, you know, the 22,000 families who are relying on it can continue to do so for the coming school year, which is great.
But at the same time, the court declined to say whether the use of allotments at private schools is constitutional. The court said that because school districts approve vendors to be paid with allotment funds, the state was the wrong party to sue. The court remanded the case to the lower court for further proceedings on that point. Attorney Scott Kendall, representing a group of public school parents who challenged the correspondence school statutes, said he wasn't surprised the court had denied the challenge on procedural grounds, given Justice's questioning on Thursday, but he said he's optimistic.
There's zero indication from the court that they remotely think spending correspondence funds at a private school is allowable. So while this will cause some delay in the ultimate outcome, we sort of just remain very, very confident that that will be the outcome.
A full decision will follow at a later date, the court said. The ruling came just days before the lower court ruling was set to take effect and just a day after the case was argued in Anchorage. Well, after a fire destroyed the school in Stebbins, local leaders are scrambling to figure out where students will go when school starts in 2 months. KNOM's Ben Townsend traveled to the scene to learn more.
N95 respirators were being handed out to residents to prevent illness from toxic fumes emanating from the ruins. The city office buzzed as people came and went, like worker bees in a busy hive. Daisy Kochiak, city administrator of Stebbins, sits in a chair in the back corner of the room. She spoke with an intensity and clarity that made everyone in the room listen and believe in every word she said.
We're doing everything we can to make accommodations for the children, to make them comfortable, to let them know that they are on the top of our list and that they are the backbone of our community, that they are our future. Yep.
Stebbins School, part of Bering Strait School District, was set to begin classes on August 21st. With the school now in ruins and a new facility taking up to 3 years to complete, Kochiak is moving quickly to find solutions. Several ideas are being put on the table, including converting facilities in Stebbins to classrooms. Kochiak hopes to send high school students to nearby St. Michael. There, the students would be able to use the school gym so they can still compete in sports. After improvements to a 10-mile road connecting the villages, the high schoolers would need to take buses daily to go to school. Bering Strait School District has said they're still in the planning phase and that no definitive decisions have been made quite yet. With support from St. Michael, Kochiak hopes to show the next generation what can be accomplished by working together.
We've been telling them for the past 2 years, your life's going to transform. Your life is going to change. Our local leaders are working hard to change your life and to change your persona of being beaten to empowering yourself with unity and teamwork.
Reporting for KNOM in Stebbins, I'm Ben Townsend.
Today, Suzanne LaFrance was sworn in as the first woman elected Anchorage mayor. Hundreds of people flocked to Town Square Park to watch LaFrance's inauguration, where she highlighted her message of good government, transparency, and accountability. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early was there and has more.
Suzanne LaFrance is not the first woman to serve as Anchorage mayor. That distinction belongs to Austin Quinn Davidson, who served as acting mayor after Ethan Berkowitz resigned following a personal scandal. However, Quinn Davidson beamed as she introduced LaFrance, talking about their work together and how the two have had to navigate a world, quote, dominated by male leaders and approaches.
I've watched Suzanne lead in her own way. Listen instead of talk. Focus on people and their needs as she navigates challenges. Return hateful words with patience and graciousness, and be willing to put herself on the line for what is right.
Following a six-year stint as an Anchorage Assembly member with 2 years as chair and a year of campaigning, LaFrance officially became mayor at 7:30 a.m. Monday. She was ceremonially sworn in by Jane Engvik, a longtime public servant who helped draft the city's charter.
And that I will faithfully perform the duties of mayor of Anchorage to the best of my ability.
And that I will faithfully perform the duties of mayor to the best of my ability.
Congratulations!
LaFrance began her remarks by highlighting her childhood, playing team sports like hockey and soccer, calling teamwork essential to who she is.
Today isn't about one single person. Today is about this special place we call home and what we're going to do together to fix it up and make it the place we all know it can be.
As LaFrance spoke, a group of roughly a dozen protesters stood nearby, holding signs and chanting through a megaphone.
What do we want? When do we want it?
Now.
What do we want? When do we want it?
During her remarks, LaFrance acknowledged the protesters.
I want to recognize the people here who are practicing their First Amendment rights.
The organization behind the protest, the Party for Socialism and Liberation Anchorage, recently launched a campaign to establish an independent police review board for the city. In the last 2 months, a string of Anchorage police shootings left 3 people dead. Advocates have pushed for the release of the officers' body camera footage, but former acting chief Bianca Cross refused, saying it will be available after investigations are complete. From day one, LaFrance says her incoming municipal attorney and the new police chief are working to increase police accountability.
They are already digging into issues and working on draft policies to ensure clearer communication and build trust between APD and the community.
In an interview after her remarks, LaFrance said top of mind is, quote, stabilizing the municipality.
Making sure that we've got a handle on the finances and that we've got the tools in place to staff up, because we know we've got a lot of vacancies and that impacts the delivery of services to residents.
She also highlighted Anchorage's housing crunch as a problem to solve, as well as how to support the city's homeless population. The inauguration ended with a performance from the Lipgenum Gummel Geet Gagogim Shimshan Dancers. As for being the first woman elected to be Anchorage mayor, LaFrance said she's proud and grateful for the women who made strides before her. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The Army's 11th Airborne Division has a new commander. Major General Joseph Hilbert assumed command of the 11th Airborne from Major General Brian Eifler Thursday in a ceremony at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, where the division is based. Hilbert will now oversee operations and training of the 11th Airborne's 12,000 soldiers stationed in Alaska at J-Bear, Fort Wainwright, and Fort Greely. Eifler has been nominated for his third star and promotion to Lieutenant General and will be heading to work in the Pentagon as the Army's Deputy Chief of Staff. That's the office that Hilbert had served in, where he worked as the Director of Force Development. The Army Corps of Engineers has begun work on an $11 million operations center at its permafrost tunnel and research complex in Fox. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the new facility will improve the Army's ability to study the effects of climate warming on ground and infrastructure stability.
Local and high-ranking officials with the Corps of Engineers broke ground Tuesday on a 4,300-square-foot operations facility at its permafrost research tunnel north of Fairbanks.
There's only two of these facilities actually in the world. One is in the United States, right here in Fox, Alaska, and one's in Russia.
David Pittman directs the Corps' Mississippi-based Army Engineer Research and Development Center, and he told about 24 people at the groundbreaking ceremony that the new permafrost tunnel facility will help researchers keep abreast of climate-driven changes in the Arctic as the Army grows its presence in the region.
So we've got to have research and development capabilities that kind of, you know, exceed all our adversaries out there.
Pittman says the new operations facility will significantly upgrade the existing 61-year-old research complex with the addition of a laboratory, administrative offices, and conference rooms.
We need a world-class facility to support the world-class research that we're doing there. And understanding permafrost is important for the world, because we got a lot of military facilities here. There's national security questions involved.
After the groundbreaking, Gary Larson, a senior member of the permafrost tunnel staff, led some of the invited guests on a tour of the tunnel.
Our number one reason for being is research, but this is part of Fort Wainwright, and so a secondary use of this tunnel is actually military.
Larson handles day-to-day operations of the complex for the Alaska Research Office of the Corps' Cold Region Research Engineering Laboratory. And he explained the scientific value of the tunnel, which provides a glimpse of what Alaska was like 45,000 years ago.
You can see a steppe bison horn with its sheep still on there. Here you see a woolly mammoth leg bone and other pieces and parts over here.
Studying the remains of ancient plants and animals embedded in the tunnel's walls, along with ice wedges and other formations, helps researchers understand how climate warming affects frozen ground. Larson says the new facility will improve that research by adding basic infrastructure to support tunnel operations, like a well and pump house and a heated garage.
Garage space that's warm, that we, so we can actually maintain our research equipment, you know, and be able to continue to use it throughout the winter, because our research isn't just in the summer, it's all year round, right?
There also will be real bathrooms instead of porta potties.
Yes, the bathroom is essential. We've worked out here for so many years without running water or indoor plumbing. We're thrilled.
Pittman said improving research at the tunnel will benefit both the military and the general public. He said it could alleviate, for example, climate change-driven impacts like those that have created a sort of roller coaster effect on a stretch of the Steese Highway just south of the tunnel.
And if you rode in on the road just coming into this facility today, you saw the impacts on the roads themselves.
He says thawing permafrost also threatens other area infrastructure, like the Corps of Engineers-operated Moose Creek Dam at the Chena Flood Control Project near North Pole.
I just visited a dam yesterday locally. It's built on permafrost. So it starts melting. Guess what's going to happen to the dam?
Work on the new permafrost tunnel operations facility is scheduled to be completed by the end of next year. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Chris Clint, Kavitha George, Liz Ruskin, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Juneau, and Ben Townsend in Stebbins. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.